Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you taking some time to join us on the podcast as we go rummaging through the big old monster box of cards from the 1980s and 1990s. We started with 81 Fleer. We're going year by year, set by set. And this time we're up to 1992 Fleer Ultra. And this was one hell of a set. This was a popular set, not just back in 1992, but 25 years later, you can look back at these cards and say, those are some nice baseball cards. And here's the best part, because it was produced in 1992, there's about 500 billion gazillion of them still out there. So you can get your hands on 92 Fleer Ultra rather easily and affordably. And when we talk about the set, you'll see why I strongly encourage you to spend a few bucks and do it, because it is a very impressive set. And we've got a very impressive random pull, card number 47, Albert Don't You Dare Call Me Joey Bell, one of the most feared hitters in Major League Baseball. And that was just away from the ballpark. You should have seen what he did when he was at home plate. I mean, this guy could swing a bat pretty good. The good news is that by all accounts, Albert Bell has mellowed with age quite a bit. In fact, he just turned 50 not that long ago. My God, we're all getting old. When Albert Bell is turning 50, you know, time is definitely flying here. Yeah, he turned 50 back in August, and he's got three kids living out in Arizona and actually enjoying life, which is a complete 180 from what we saw when he was playing primarily with the Cleveland Indians, but later in his career with Baltimore and the Chicago White Sox. So we'll talk about Albert Bell's career. We'll talk about the Hall of Fame worthy numbers that he put up and why it's going to be a very long time until he gets in. And then on top of that, we'll talk about his resurrection too. As I said, he's kind of, I don't want to say turned his life around, but it's certainly by some of the interviews that I've read has turn things into a much more positive direction than where he was 25 years ago when he was just starting to rise up amongst the ranks of great hitters in Major League Baseball. So we'll talk about him. We'll talk about the 92 Fleer Ultra set. And we'll also talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. But first, I want to give a shout out to the guys at Beckett Radio. I was their guest earlier this week. We recorded the interview, and the episode is out now. It came out on Thursday afternoon. And if you don't follow Beckett Radio on Twitter, it's very easy to find the podcast. If you go to soundcloud.com and just type in Beckett Radio, you'll have the list of tracks come up, and it says January 19th or 119 on it. And I'm the first guest on the show, and the interview starts about, 11:27 into the show. So if you're a little impatient, you just want to scan ahead, you can do that. But my thanks to Eric Norton and Paul Wirth for having me on. We spoke for probably about a half hour and had a lot of fun talking about the podcast, you know, how it came about, how it's actually kind of changed ever since it started, how I got into the hobby, also my day job, if you want to know more about what the director of the NHL's Tampa Bay Lightning does when he's not doing this podcast, but also, you know, a little hockey talk too. I mean, we cover it all, and it was a lot of fun, and certainly hope some point in time I'll be able to get back on the program. So Beckett Radio, again, if you're not following them on Twitter, first of all, you should, as Eric and Paul do a great job with their show, but you should also track down the program that I was on SoundCloud. Again, just type in Beckett Radio and you'll see the track listing right there. Now, speaking of that show, before we went on, Joey W. reached out to me via Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains and said, you must give the Beckett Radio guys your Harry Carey impersonation. I am saddened to inform you, Joey, that we didn't get around to the Harry Carey impersonation. And, you know, it's something I was prepared for because you brought it up and you tagged them in the comment. But it didn't happen. Nobody asked me to talk. I've been told to shut up for decades. I've been dead for 20 years. But people just want to keep hearing me talk. So I'm just going to drown my sorrows in a Budweiser. Well, actually, that's what I call breakfast, but I'll do it anyway. Who knows, Joey, maybe one day, the next time I'm on the program, it'll come up and we'll get around to it. But until then, we're going to put Harry Carey back in the box. Close the box, all right? It's all right. Other comments at Waxing Gum Stains. A lot of thoughts about, first of all, Donruss Triple Play. We did get a couple stragglers in the conversation. We did the Donruss Triple Play review three podcasts ago, I should say. And one of the questions that I asked about the 92 Triple Play, because it was targeted towards kids age 5 through 12, I asked the question, if you were between the age of 5 and 12 back in 1992, did Donruss Triple Play, because it was aimed towards younger kids, did it make you actually buy more of their product, or at least buy more baseball cards just in general? So didn't get much of a reaction at first. And I joked around that, clearly nobody's, listening to me. And of course, some of you did come to my rescue and said, no, I'm listening. I'm just older. I didn't necessarily fit into that age range there. And that's perfectly fine. I mean, like I said, I was 14 when it came out and I still liked it. So I was an outlier at that older age, but we did have some commentary. Wax Pack 916, I was at top of age group, didn't have Triple Play. 92 was all about Upper Deck, Top, Stadium Club, and Donruss. And then the key to your comment here, too many choices. Yes, too many choices. And you look at the other sets that you were collecting, Tops, which was greatly improved in 92. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Donruss, Upper Deck, Stadium Club, all of those cards, very worthy quality and good selection and some good value at the time for the rookies and star players there. So if you're putting your money and time and attention to those four brands in particular, Donruss Triple Play was not very entertaining to you, especially if you were at the older end of that age range. And one other comment regarding that topic, Brian Hayes says, I was 12 in 1992, was not interested in Triple Play then. I bought Upper Deck, Pinnacle, and Leaf that year. So once again, even as a 12-year-old, Brian was buying more of the upper echelon, not buying the product that was trying to catch up to Upper Deck, but getting Upper Deck, Leaf, and Pinnacle. I totally forgot about Pinnacle. Pinnacle is one that I didn't buy. That was one set, even though I tried pretty much every set that came out, I would buy a pack or two of every set back in 92 and 93, back when you had like 18 sets being produced. Pinnacle was one that I just didn't go after. I just never really cared for it for whatever reason. I can't think of why, but I just didn't. So that answers our question on Donruss Triple Play. Did it actually help grow the industry or grow Donruss's bottom line? Well, by our rather informal poll, no, it didn't. It didn't exactly move the needle there. Moving on to a different topic. In fact, our most recent podcast on 92 Fleer, Bean's Ball Card Blog comments, I like that they went to the modern look, but was never a fan of the set. I can't place a finger on why, though. To which Robbie T, also known as Booby Maine, again, I would like to know the backstory of that, or maybe I don't, says the metallic teal looks awful, a color of its time, though. So that's an interesting give and take there. As I mentioned in the podcast, that green color I actually did like, although I may have this subconscious childhood memory why I liked it. And that is because my family had a car that was that color once. So it wasn't a very good car. I remember it was the first car with power windows. So that was kind of fun, when the car was working and you could actually get the windows down. But yeah, metallic teal, I wouldn't call it metallic teal. It's more of a green than teal. I never liked teal as a color. In fact, I refused back then to call it teal because teal just sounded too teal-ish. I don't know what the word is to describe it, but I used to call it blue-green or aqua-green. Now, this was a little more emerald green if you want to get real picky with the color of it. But, for some reason, some people like that color and some don't. Whether it reminds you of a 1979 Ford LTD or roughly the same color of shag carpeting that everybody had in their living room in the 1970s, that could be a pretty good reason why you don't like it. Tim Murray, on card front, the font of player's last name was bigger than photo of player. And if you look at the example of our random pull with Mo Vaughn, yeah, the last name is almost bigger than he is. although I'm sure that was just an optical illusion performed by Fleer to make Mo Vaughn look just a tad bit skinnier than usual. Now, some people did like 92 Fleer, including AP Sports Cards. Oh my, still have a ton of those stashed in a box somewhere, so you didn't get them totally out of your closet, so I guess you still have some reason to like him. Ben Adams says Fleer did a complete 180 from 91 to 92. Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons why I like the 92 set. And it's so funny, isn't it? I mean, when you look at baseball card sets from year to year, sometimes what makes a set look good is that it was just aesthetically more pleasing than the previous year's set, and vice versa. A set that is not as popular just didn't quite live up to, you know, the design expectations of collectors the year after. And I think, you know, you look at Topps in particular, 85 was very well liked by collectors. 86, not as many people like it. 87, you know, 99% of the collectors that I know of love the 87 Topps set. But 88 Topps falls short amongst their expectations. And I think it's interesting how one card set just on design alone can either have a fan club or have a lot of people just absolutely dislike it. And that's even before you get into, well, what rookie cards are in here, what inserts are in here, and all that stuff. If the card doesn't look appealing, you're not going to buy it. And that was definitely the case of 91 Fleer, and why I think a lot of people, even if you're not crazy about the green color on the front of the card, you like 92 Fleer just because it was a leap ahead of what the 91 disaster looked like. And one final thought from WaxPack916, who has told us that he is trying to get every 1991 Topps card of his signed by the players. Now, that's an endeavor. It's a 792 card set. And I do know a few of the players since then have passed, but at least the living players, he's trying to get those cards signed. He sends a picture of a 90 Donruss Greg Harris card that is autographed, but that's not the card he sent out. He says, never owned a 90 Donruss card, sent three cards to Mr. Harris. He kept mine and sent this back. 90 Donruss is like a bad penny. Or maybe not a bad penny, but with all due respect to my friends in Canada, you know, the Canadian quarter, you get that handful of pocket change. You actually pay with cash for something and you get a handful of pocket change and you get the quarter back, but it's a Canadian quarter. And again, I love Canada. I love visiting Canada. I love my Canadian friends. I love everything about Canada. But the Canadian quarter in the U.S., first of all, it's only worth about three quarters of its value. So it's only worth about 18 and a half cents. Second, the vending machines don't take it. It's like the most useless coin that has value but doesn't have value. That's pretty much 90 Donruss, I think. A bad penny or a Canadian quarter, no doubt about it. But also, I do believe that this is common. You know, there is a line forming for Greg Harris's autograph, so maybe he just got his cards mixed up. Or maybe Greg Harris is a collector and we don't know it. And he's just sitting there going, holy crap, what am I going to do with all these 90 Donruss cards? I know, I'll send them out with my autograph request. Pretty smart move there, Mr. Harris. Touche, I may say. So that's our look at the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed. If you're new to Wax Ecstatic, we talk about what you're talking about at Wax and Gum Stains. Twitter feed's open 24/7, and we certainly enjoy looking at your comments about the podcast, about the players we feature, or just the hobby in general. We got a little bit of all of that in this week's edition. Also, if you're new to Wax Ecstatic, we come your way twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays, via Audio Boom and iTunes. And as I mentioned at the start of the show, it all starts with a monster box. It was just sitting in a closet, really, I would say, untouched for maybe 3 or 4 years. And I just started going through it and thought, well, it'd be kind of fun to share this with people who share the same memories about the hobby. I got rid of a lot of my cards from the junk wax era, but I kept kept more than a few from the 80s and into the early 90s, but definitely the early 90s. I have a select group of cards that I managed to hang on to. And we're right in the thick of that. You know, my set, or my collection, I should say, pretty much ends in 1993. So we'll trudge through 1992 and go into 1993. And then I'm going to leave it up to you. You know, we'll come up with a formal survey. Exactly what are we doing for the next edition of Wax Ecstatic. So once we get through 93, you know, there's no new sets for me. I'm not going to sit here and go through some of the new sets that are coming out. So we'll find out which direction we go in when that point in time comes. Now, when it came to 92 Fleer Ultra, the direction they went in was a very good direction. Let's first back up to 1991. Of course, the 91 Fleer set was a disaster. We all agree on that. But 91 was the first year that Fleer put out an Ultra set. And I said this during the 91 Fleer podcast a few weeks ago. I said, you know, 91 Fleer Ultra, that was also a half-baked concept. Everyone was trying to create this premium product, and Fleer just fell totally flat on that. While Topps had the great Stadium Club, and of course they had Bowman, an extension of theirs, that was really a big hit back in 92. And then you had Leaf was picking up the pace with their quality, and of course you had the Leaf Studio cards. Fleer Ultra was almost like a poor man's Leaf in 1991. Gray borders, okay photographs. On the back you had kind of this montage of photographs on top of stats, but nothing that really made you say, I need to go out and get that. It was just one of those kind of sets that, you know, masqueraded as premium, but it really wasn't. Well, they certainly turned that around in 1992 with the Fleer Ultra set, as the Fleer Ultra set caught up not only with Upper Deck, which is what everybody was trying to do in 92, but I think it was catching up to Top Stadium Club. And I really thought when Stadium Club came out in 91, that really set the bar for premium cards. Like, now all of a sudden Upper Deck had to catch up to Stadium Club and everything else that was made after it. And Fleer Ultra, I think, got right up there with an absolutely beautiful card. And all you have to do is just take a look at our random pull. Again, card number 47, Albert Bell. We'll talk about him in just a few minutes. But let's take a look at the front of the card. First of all, you will notice no borders. And again, well, I mean, there's a little bit of a marble border at the bottom, but it's so subdued. It almost looks like a borderless card here. And again, while a lot of the credit goes to Upper Deck for revolutionizing the hobby back in 1989, and rightfully so, they took some big steps forward and kept going, and it forced everybody else to catch up to them. Upper Deck didn't do the borderless card until 1993. In fact, when we look at 92 Upper Deck in a couple of podcasts, you will see that they still had some work to do. It was a work in progress, and it was a quality set in 1992. But you look at what Stadium Club and Ultra was putting out at the time, and it paled in comparison. And this is a great shot of Albert Bell at the old Cleveland Stadium about to smack that ball 430 feet to left field. And it's a great full-color shot. Ultra couldn't have the bragging rights of this was filmed on Kodak. You know, they kind of had that co-sponsor with the Top Stadium Club. But it's still some crystal clear, beautiful photography that was used on the front of these cards. And in the upper left-hand corner, you have the Fleer Ultra logo, which is a little big. It stands out a bit, but the Ultra is, and also the word Fleer, I should say, but Fleer and Ultra are in the gold foil, which was the new craze in the hobby in 92. Right beneath the picture of Albert Bell, there's a small, thin gold foil line. And then you had a little bar with the player's name, and beneath that, a little bar, more narrower bar, even though it was longer, with the player's team and position. And that set on a marble, you know, kind of a greenish marble base, which again, because, and especially this is a great example of it, it was subdued. You know, if you're kind of looking at this card from a distance, the marble almost looks like grass. I mean, you could argue that, you know, if you didn't really take a good close look at it, that this is just the grass surrounding home plate at Cleveland Municipal Stadium, probably just as hard. But, you know, the marble was a very nice touch, and it's something that you would see on the back of the card. So let's flip the card over here, and you'll see that there's a marble backdrop that is, you know, supposed to, it gives the impression that's across the entire back of the card. But you also have this rather neat, it's a very 1992 look here, a family double dare kind of look, or a, you know, geisha house look here. The the interlocking grid with it was different colors too, depending on the team, and the Indians with a primary color of red that was used as the background there. It's almost like a hot plate red. You know, it's darker in one area and lighter in the other. You have the big smiling racist Chief Wahoo right underneath the card number in the upper right hand corner. Very small writing, the player's personal information that became less and less of a need or a want in some of the cards that were being produced in 1992. You have the player's name spread out over two of those bars, and then you have a larger bar at the bottom showing his stats from 1991 and then his major league career stats. So Fleer Ultra going the route of where Donruss Triple Play went and where, you know, some other card companies would go down the line where instead of listing the entire player's career, it was just the previous season and his major league career. Now, Ultra didn't go with the full montage of photographs, but they would often use two different photographs on the back of the card. One would be kind of a faraway action shot, and here you have Albert Bell holding up on a pitch, glaring at the umpire like, "You're going to call that a ball, aren't you? Aren't you? Aren't you? I've got a bat in my hand." You know, he's got that look in his eyes. And then you've got the close-up action picture of Albert Bell kissing it goodbye as that one goes a mere 422 feet over the right field fence. So a very good use of extra pictures, but not going overboard. Even though there's a lot happening here, it's still very simple. It is not cluttered. Unlike 92 Donruss, which, again, I give credit to for changing the backs of their cards and dropping in a player picture and trying to make it all seamless. But with all the information that was on the back of a 92 Donruss card, it got a little too cluttered. 92 Fleer Ultra, very, very clean. Now, also, you can almost smell it through this picture. The UV coating, which was also another hot trend. You know, gone were the days of just foil being good enough for a baseball card. You had to have thick cardstock and UV coating, which did cause some problems where the cards would stick together, you know, especially if they were sitting in the packs with stuff stacked on top of them. I don't think that Fleer Ultra had as bad of a sticking problem as Top Stadium Club had. At least that's how my memory serves me. Again, I only have a small collection of them. While Stadium Club, I tend to have a lot more from back in the day lingering around. But if I remember correctly, the Fleer Ultra set in 1992 did not adhere, you know, from one card to another as badly as Top Stadium Club did. In fact, I still kind of cringe at the idea of the Top Stadium Club cards clinging to each other as you're trying to delicately pull them apart so as not to damage them as you're looking through your collection or trying to put them into the plastic pages. But the ultraviolet protection, of course, was to try to add a little shine to the card. It was also supposed to protect it from fading, and it did make getting autographs rather difficult. Again, with the UV coating, a player would have to use his thumb, you know, having to, you know, rub a little dry spot out there and then, you know, sign his name to it before it, you know, got back to normal. So that made autograph hunting a little difficult back in the day. But it's an absolutely beautiful set. And what's really floored me is how affordable this is. Now, one reason why it is affordable, it's from 1992. And this was at the peak of the card collecting hobby slash industry, where every new set had literally 4 to 5 million cards produced. And that's not sets, that's individual cards produced. So there's still plenty of this product out there. But this is one of those sets where I say, even though the individual value of the cards or the set is not that much, in fact, you only have a handful of cards that are valued at a dollar or more. I mean, you don't have any, with the exception of one, which I'll get to in a moment, you don't really have any rookie card or star card that's worth $10 or $20, at least ungraded. If you go through the grading process, then yeah, you can give it a higher price. But ungraded, the bigger cards, and there's only a handful of them in the set, they're only worth about $1, $1.25. So I've seen sets that are going for, and I've only seen hand-collated sets. I haven't seen factory sets, but hand-collated sets for around $20. Here's the kicker, though. I have seen boxes of either Series 1 or Series 2 that are on sale for less than $10 a box. I've seen jumbo packs. I've seen all sorts of 92 Fleer Ultra. And this is just doing a quick scan of just, you know, Google shopping links and you know, visiting a couple of card sites and eBay that I trust. And I mean, you can have a couple of these boxes for $20 out the door. So again, it's one of those sets that you're not going to make a lot of money off of, but it's a beautiful set. It's a landmark set for Fleer Ultra. It is one of the best, if not the best, in 1992. You can argue that Stadium Club was up there. You can argue that Bowman had the best set. But in terms of design, in terms of look, in terms of star power, this is an absolute winner. So this is one of those sets where if you have a few extra dollars, you got a little extra time, you feel like ripping open some packs and just seeing what you've got, definitely do it with 92 Fleer Ultra. I can't believe that some of these boxes, you know, factory sealed boxes are going for this cheap. I may even, you know, find a few extra dollars out of my next tax return and buy a couple boxes of this particular set. It is just that big of a steal and really one of my favorites. And the good news, too, is that not only are these cards affordable and easy to find, but also this set came in two series, but was only 600 total cards, much like Top Stadium Club. So you're not trying to chase a 900 card set like Score was at that time. You're not trying to chase a 900 card set with 48 different insert cards. No, the only insert card which does have some value, which I was alluding to earlier, that is still out there and is extremely valuable because unfortunately this person has passed on, Tony Gwynn autographed cards. Fleer Ultra put out a very special Tony Gwynn insert set. And on top of that insert set, there are an estimated 2,000 cards of each card that are signed. And what I mean by that is Gwynn supposedly signed 2,000 of card number one, 2,000 of card number two. But that number can't be verified because, again, you're asking him to sign 20,000 cards, and that's an awful lot of wear and tear on one of the best hitters' wrist. So there is some discrepancies out there as to exactly how many he signed. But 25 years later, there are still some autographed cards floating around in factory-sealed products. So that may be worth the investment itself. You know, especially if you're a Tony Gwynn fan, you may want to spend $50, get four or five boxes and press your luck with that. So that's one, again, you know, I advise you to buy it and try it out, not because you're going to get rich off of it, but this is one of the best values in, if you're going to spend $10 for a box of cards, it might as well be 92 Fleer Ultra as opposed to, you know, 91 Score or 90 Donruss or one of the other card sets from that day. Now, Albert Bell is a very interesting story because, you know, I joke about it, but this guy was one of the most feared hitters in Major League Baseball. And if it wasn't for his rotten attitude back then, I think he would be considered for the Hall of Fame. And by the way, I should have mentioned this at the top of the show. Congratulations to Jeff Bagwell, Tim Raines, and Ivan Rodriguez. Rodriguez surprised me a bit because, you know, I didn't think he would get in first ballot. And I also thought that, you know, some of the steroid allegations and, you know, the allegations on him were not as heavy as other players from that era. He was named in Jose Canseco's book as somebody who he personally shot up. He was very deflective on talking about the Mitchell report. Did it name him? Rodriguez said, you know, God only knows, which is not exactly. And hey, who am I to dispute God? But that's not exactly. No, I'm definitely not in there. But congratulations to them. And, you know, it's going to be fun seeing them inducted this upcoming summer. Of course, there's a lot of love for the defunct Montreal Expos. I know that was a big driving force for Tim Raines, although statistically speaking, he definitely deserved it. I thought Bagwell was very deserving. And I just thought Rodriguez would eventually get in, not first ballot. But congratulations to him. And I said this on the Beckett Radio podcast. Ivan Rodriguez, when you look at just the numbers on the field, he was one of the big reasons why the Texas Rangers became relevant in the mid-90s. I forgot he won a World Series with the Marlins back in 2003, and he had a great career, very lengthy career. He retired, I think 2011 was his last season. So it was a bit of a surprise to me, but If you just look at the numbers, then yes, he is definitely worthy. If you just look at the career numbers of Albert Bell, he is definitely worthy as well. So let me read the numbers here. 295 batting average, 381 home runs, 1,239 RBI. This was in an injury-shortened 12-year career. Albert Bell was a five-time All-Star, was the runner-up in the AL MVP vote in 1995. He finished third in the vote in 94 and 96, and he was also a five-time Silver Slugger. So you would think that one of the most terrifying hitters in Major League Baseball, who also had a career OPS of .933, would be a shoe-in for the Hall of Famer, at least in the conversation. Well, that is not the case. In fact, he was only on the ballot for 2 years, and he fell underneath the 5% barrier after year number two. And the main reason why is because he was very problematic, to put it nicely, off the field. It is well documented his alcohol abuse very early on in his life, which he had to take some time away from. I believe in 1990, he had to step away from the game for a little bit. But, you know, he had a very bad attitude. He had numerous run-ins with fans off the field, with reporters, especially, you know, Hannah Storm in particular back in 1995. You know, I wish I could figure out what was behind all this anger. He has said before that, you know, he wasn't a steroid abuser. He claims to be clean, and there's really no other allegations or hints that there was any shenanigans going on with him. But he has said before that he was just an angry black man. So I don't know if that was said tongue in cheek. I don't know if there was some kind of a racial issue going on there. All I do know is that he was not well liked by certainly the press and the media, but certainly front offices of teams. You know, after a few years, they got tired of him. Other players would get tired of him. And it's rather unfortunate because Albert Bell was just an incredible player, an absolutely incredible player. Native of Shreveport, Louisiana, a twin, by the way. He has a fraternal twin, Terry. He's an Eagle Scout, and that's cool. I'm an Eagle Scout, so it's always nice to link yourself up to other Eagle Scouts. He was a member of the National Honor Society, also a vice president of the Shreveport Future Business Leaders of America. So, I mean, this guy had, you know, very good education, very good entrepreneurial skills as well. Could have played for Notre Dame, could have played for the Air Force, or not just played for the Air Force, could have enlisted in the Air Force, but decided to stay close to home, played at LSU, and was just an absolute monster at LSU, as you would imagine. And he was drafted by the Cleveland Indians in the second round back in 1987 and took a very, very, very fast track to the major leagues as he made his debut in 1989. As I mentioned, dealing with some substance abuse early on in his career, only played 62 games in 1989 and 9 games in 1990. But as the Indians were hitting rock bottom, but building their way up, very well known that, you know, the 1991 squad, which if I remember correctly, lost 105 games that year. You not only had Albert Bell, you had Sandy Alomar Jr., you had Omar Vizquel, you had a team that was up on the rise, and Albert Bell was really the core piece of that team. And 1991 was his breakout year in 123 games, hit 28 home runs, 95 RBI, and also only struck out 99 times, not bad with 496 plate appearances. And then he becomes essentially a full-time outfielder the following season in 1992 with 153 games, 651 plate appearances, 34 home runs, 112 RBI, an on-base percentage of .320, slugging percentage of .477. You do the math there, an OPS of .797. So, I mean, you could just see this guy was going to be something very special. And you look at his career numbers afterwards. He led the American League in RBI in 1993 with 129, also led in 95 and 96 with 126 and 148 respectively. In 95, which was a slightly shorter season because of the strike that dragged on a little bit, 50 home runs for him in 631 plate appearances, a slugging percentage of 690. I mean, this guy was just an absolute beast. But again, he wore out his welcome in Cleveland, especially in the 1995 World Series. Like I said, he had that blow up with Hannah Storm during the World Series. And he was just this very surly guy. He had run-ins with fans and media. And the Indians, who had a lot of talent by then and were trying to build something long-term, figured that it was actually worthwhile walking away from Albert Bell, letting him sign on somewhere else as a free agent, instead of just having to deal with his nonsense for another few more years. So heading into the 1997 season, he signed a five-year, $55 million deal with the Chicago White Sox, at the time the most lucrative contract in baseball. And he actually had a pretty good start in Chicago in 97 and 98. But he started having some hip injuries and issues with his hip and back. And he also had a very interesting clause in his contract. Good luck getting a contract like this today, where he had to be the highest paid player in baseball. So he basically had this out clause where if he didn't feel that he was being properly compensated, he could void the deal. So in 1998, he puts the clause into effect and says, well, I need to get paid more money. And the White Sox say, no, you don't. So he becomes a free agent again, and he again becomes the game's highest paid player. So a five-year, $65 million deal with the Baltimore Orioles. But again, due to hip injuries that continue to chip away at his career and then eventually totally derail his career, he wasn't able to fulfill all five of those years. In fact, he only played two seasons with the Baltimore Orioles. What was a problematic hip injury, you know, one that was just nagging in his last couple of seasons with Cleveland and in both seasons in Chicago, even though he played full seasons in Chicago, it finally took him down in his final season in Baltimore. Did appear in 161 games in 1999. With 37 home runs, 117 RBI, and a .297 batting average, but the hip limitations in 2000 kept him to 141 games, not bad. 23 home runs, 103 RBI, and a .281 batting average. But if you recall, the Orioles were starting to hit rock bottom in 99 and 2000. Certainly, you know, when Cal Ripken Jr. was leaving the team, and you know, he had that big farewell tour. But, you know, the Orioles were definitely long in the tooth by then. And one of the main reasons was Albert Bell. This was a guy that just wasn't able to produce anymore. So that big five-year contract, yeah, he still got paid for it, but only was able to play for 2 years of it. Now, after his career, he, you know, settled down a little bit. Like I said, started a family, is married, has three kids, lives in Arizona. And thanks to an interview with him by the Sporting News this past, I want to say September, it was fairly recently, you can see that Albert Bell has mellowed out quite a bit. And, you know, he says that, you know, things are different when you're 25 than when you're 50. You know, you're not playing with a chip on your shoulder. You're not living life on the edge. And I can actually see where Albert is coming from. You know, there's a very big difference. And think about this, too. If you're roughly my age, you know, you're close to 40 or somewhere within a few years of 40, you are living totally differently now than, you know, never mind 25, even 30, because, you know, priorities are different. Life is different. And, hey, I have my fun when I was 20, 21, 25, you know, certainly in my 20s. But I couldn't live that way now, and I certainly wouldn't expect anybody to want me to live that way, because you know there comes a point in life where you have to grow up, and it sounds like that Albert Bell has done that. And a very interesting comment in that article as well, as I mentioned, you know, Bell had some business acumen even back in high school and going into college. He wanted to purchase a minority investment in the Kansas City Royals not too long ago, but for some reason wasn't able to pull it all together. And I would actually like to see Albert Bell whether it's minority or majority owner, get into the financial side of baseball. I think that would be outstanding. I think it would be very interesting because there's no doubt that Albert Bell knows how to play the game. There's no doubt that Albert Bell was very passionate about the game. Some will say too passionate and too emotional. But you can't be too emotional or passionate as a business owner. So I would like to actually see that balance of Albert Bell as owner and leader of a ball club from the ownership side. I think that would be great. So for me personally, I hope Albert Bell at some point in time gets that chance to be at the very least a minority owner of a Major League Baseball team. And as time goes on, if everything works out right, perhaps a majority owner. I really would like to see that. I'd be curious to see how that goes. And again, I don't think it's for any token reason or we're hoping for a train wreck kind of reason here. I just think it would be very interesting to see what he could do as an owner. So best of luck to Albert Bell, not only raising three kids, which is hard enough, but getting the foot in the door into the Major League Baseball Ownership Club. I hope he succeeds there. So that's a 92 Fleer Ultra and the life story of Albert Bell. He succeeded. He is succeeding now. Fleer Ultra, a very successful set. And again, you know, this is a set that you're not going to make a ton of money off of. Don't expect that. But you can get a lot of this card for a very low price. And because of how nice of a card this is, and the fact there are still some autographed Tony Gwynn cards floating around in factory sealed packages, I would not be ashamed to drop $20 for two boxes of these and open them up and just see what you have inside. At the very least, you have some damn nice cards to look at. And there's definitely nothing wrong with that. So check out 92 Fleer Ultra the next time you're at your local hobby shop, a card show, or if you're cruising around online, eBay or whatever trusted shop you go to. I think it would actually be something that is very worthy of investing your time and money in. Again, not to make a fortune off of, but just because it's a nice set. It really is. And I think, you know, whatever you get out of it, you would actually enjoy. So there you go. 92 Fleer Ultra, our set from this week. And our next podcast, which will be coming up on Tuesday, we're going to take a look at 92 Score. So some of the sets we looked at, Fleer Ultra, big step forward. Fleer, big step forward. Donruss, big step forward. Earlier, we looked at Bowman, big step forward for them in 1992. Could Score do the same thing? In my opinion, they fell well short of it. In fact, the 92 set, kind of the downfall of the Score brand, which is unfortunate because Score was really, you know, noteworthy and trend-setting in 1988 when it made its debut, but Score could not keep up with the competition. And you'll see why. If you forgot about 92 Score, you'll see why when we take a look at the 92 Score set in our next podcast. That's coming your way on Tuesday. Wax Ecstatic is here every Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom and iTunes. To all of our new listeners, thanks for following us. Listen to our archive shows on Audio Boom and iTunes. And for all of our listeners, new, old, or somewhere in between, I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time on Wax Ecstatic.